Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Keith Brabender, and this show is called Old and New. And today I'm going to talk about France and Charlie Hebdo, which has been all over the internet. But what I want to talk about specifically is through my college education and life, the 50-year battle that has gone on or more over the use of art in society. And it really was a big deal in the Cold War. And the arguments were very severely divided amongst the population and the intelligentsia between their depiction of the right and the left. In France, for example, there were signs that were carried during the protesting of the shootings, and they kept saying they didn't want to they didn't want to give in to fascism. Well, this is a direct stab at the right wing, who was always accused of wanting to censor what's going on in society. But of course, we know the left actually in its history was probably the most brutal towards artists that maybe of any government society. So anyway, I'm going to try to get into that today. I just want to remind you that I have two books on Amazon, one called A Deserted Place, which is a novel, and one called The Summit of Things, which is a book of poetry. And I want to remind you that my name, you can get either one under my name or the names of the books, Deserted Place or The Summit of Things, and that my name is Keith Brabender, and that this show is called Old and New. And I'm sure you know the story of the men who were killed in France who ran a magazine, a satirical magazine, and they were killed, according to the government story, by two men, and then another man who was in conjunction with them, and he took hostages, and he killed some of them, and then there have now been multiple arrests around the world. I'm trying to figure out how many people are connected to it. And this attack has been taken credit for by an Al-Qaeda member. Whether or not he really did do it, I can't say, because people take credit for things on occasion they didn't do. And on the other hand, they try to hide from things that they did do. So it's, in that sense, it's very hard to know. However, I'm not going to get into that side of it today, because I still think there's some sorting out that has to be done. What I'm very interested in is this argument, which became very, very important to Western society after World War II, over the role of the artistic community in society. It became really important after World War II because, again, of the two great and horrifying governments of the day, and that was the Nazi Party under Adolf Hitler and the Communist Party under Joseph Stalin. There is no possible way to describe the treatment of the artistic community by either party in good terms, because in order to survive in either society, the artistic community had to toe the line, and the ramifications of not towing the line could be torture and death. Stalin waged war against a great deal of the artistic community. He did allow some of it to go on for very different political reasons, but everybody knows the gulags and the entire prison system was very much used against artists. And there's another thing that is always used against the artistic spirit, and that is psychiatry. One of the underlying things that Stalin did that was desperately evil, but we don't really like to talk about, because America sometimes does the same thing in much smaller ways, but it's done. And that is, if somebody is doing something we don't like, we attempt to have a psychiatrist tell everybody they're crazy. And that way, the person becomes a mental patient instead of somebody to listen to, because you never listen to a mental patient. And Stalin used the psychiatric wards of the Soviet Union a great deal in that respect. Obviously, if you opposed him, you had to be crazy. So, I mean, it was an easy thing to do in that way, if you could get the cooperation of the medical community. And that's another subject, too. which they've had books written about it, about the Nazis, but I don't know how many have been written about the Soviet Union, in which the medical community at any given time in a certain society really does cooperate with the government and does things that one would never associate with the Hippocratic Oath. But anyway, to get to the topic of the day here, back in World War II, after World War II was over, we understood the fact that governments really tried to oppress and go after artists. Now, why would a society, and why would one of the very first people that a government would go after would be the artistic community? Because if you study totalitarian states, they understand how important the artistic community and the written community is to the society. If you're going to control the means of information, as Joseph Goebbels did in the Nazi Party, for example, all the way till the very end of the war, you have to be in control of the what is publicly disseminated. And they, as propagandists, they are very aware of how powerful images are. The government spent a lot of time creating images. If you think about a presidential press conference that Barack Obama has all the time, well, maybe not as many as he should, but he does have them. It's an image. The people in the White House create an image for you. He's always standing very often out in a garden. It's really beautiful. He's very well dressed. There's American flags around. They decide how many, what kind of people are going to stand behind him or with him, what they look like, who they are. The whole thing is a staged process, because when you see him, it may not be as important to you as to exactly what he has said as to how it looks. The whole governmental atmosphere, the dignity and the power of the office. And somehow, if you do listen to what he says, that image changes your perception of what he's telling you, because it's coming from this source that has this particular grandiose and very often very, I guess, the best aristocratic look about it. Now, in the case of Charlie Hebdo, which was a magazine that did a lot of depictions of, in a satirical way, of the Muslim faith, and they did it very much on purpose, almost as a way of trying to defy everybody's fear of it. They are into an area that is really complicated in government, in the mind of the government, and in the mind of society. And that's satire, and that's humor. The general way in which governments go after people who are totalitarian is the first people they go after are the satirists and the humorists and the image makers and cartoons and things, because, as I said, the image is such a powerful thing. But satire is something that governments very often cannot stand personally. They find it very, very disconcerting often to see it. Now, we in America try to pretend that we don't, because if you've ever watched the yearly press conference they have, or the dinner they have, the dinner of the Washington Press, they actually have people come to those dinners in front of the current president and do a satire of him. I saw this with George W. Bush. He was sitting there and a man came in and pretended he was George Bush. We do this because we want to give the impression that that satire and humor are not something that deeply affect us, that it's okay with us. We're a free society. We believe in free speech. We don't get upset about it, and it's all okay. But I think in many ways this is, again, a PR and very phony, because the guy who went to sat and stood in front of George Bush, he knew there was a limitation as to what he could say. And I say it's phony because it goes back again to my favorite period, which is the 1960s, in which there were people who did things that were utterly and completely unbridled, who did things that had no limitations on what they could do. And there was a humor in the 1960s, a very dark and brutal humor that had absolutely no limits to it. And a public extension of this was National Lampoon, the magazine. And what I would like to talk about is a personal experience, if I could, with this, because it's way I want to get into what I think is really the big deal. Back in the 1970s, when I was in graduate school, I actually met at a dinner and spent some time with the editor of National Lampoon, and his name is P.J. O'Rourke. P.J. O'Rourke, since then, and this is the early 70s, or late 70s, has gone through a radical transformation of character. He's now considered one of the leading Rush Limbaugh-type conservative commentators in the United States, and a lot of men, some men did this between the 70s and the 90s through the Reagan period. But I met him, and I met a couple writers for him, and one of them in particular eventually became a very famous movie director. So I was just sitting around with these younger men, but they were pretty moderately famous, and we were, you know, they were having drinks and eating dinner and talking. And I don't want to go into all the details of what they said because it would be pretty droll and, you know, probably not very interesting. But the key factor in all of this is, in retrospect, and even at the time, I was only in, you know, my 21 or 22, was how adolescent it was. It was kind of really almost scary to me when I was there to sit and listen to these men who were very famous and were making films, Animal House. They were talking about Animal House and how they did it and what the motivations were for a lot of it. And one guy actually, I think it might have been O'Rourke, but it could have been somebody else, actually said at the dinner, you know, at this kind of a cocktail party dinner we had, that when he read the script, he didn't think it was funny. And somebody asked him why, and he said, because I had lived through it all. To me, it was just the way a fraternity house worked, and I didn't understand why somebody else would find what I was doing funny. But the truth is, if you listen to the jokes they told at the time, and you listen to the stories they told at the time, it was all just deeply adolescent. You had this feeling that you were trapped in like the eighth grade, and that they never got out of it. And when you hear this kind of thing, you start to wonder if this is what ultimately offends a lot of conservative people about the attitude of the artistic community, particularly in satire and in magazines, is that they claim they're holding up a higher moral end and that they're doing something great for society because they're liberal and they don't want to be restricted and they want to have this freedom to do what they want and say what they want. And I don't remember the specifics of it particularly, but I do remember P.J. O'Rourke at the time carrying on about he had seen a priest somewhere and just started going on and on and on about Catholic priests in this really weird and juvenile fashion, in my opinion. The point I'm making is, that's what struck me at the time. Now, I saw P.J. O'Rourke much later in his life now, and he is certainly not adolescent anymore. But it is funny that sometimes the left comes off as being deeply adolescent. And they portray themselves as quite the opposite. And in fact, there are leftists who are very offended by the adolescence. A lot of the women feminists who came out of the 70s wrote articles about the fact that the male humor of the 60s, which was supposed to be some kind of liberating genre, was very adolescent and just demeaning to everybody and served no useful social purpose in helping anybody do anything. But these things are always done in the name of freedom. And now, if you want a radical example of the freedom of speech done in the name of freedom over the last 60 years, it's Larry Flynt, who ran Hustler magazine, find as many utterly offensive pictures as he could, and then he would publish them and then tell everybody he was doing it in the name of free speech. The irony to all of this is we as a country actually never faced this head on, because by the time we started to do it, by the time there were actual pornographic court cases in America, and there was this great debate that went on about community standards and whether or not you were permitted to publish certain kinds of things and the arguments that went on. I lived in a county in Hamilton County, was very famous for it. They had a couple of different pornography trials that had to do with art exhibits and and the right of the individual artist to post on a wall what he wanted, and one with Larry Flint, which they made a movie out of, the USA versus Larry Flint or whatever it's called. I lived in the community where this was there, but eventually it was eliminated, not out of any particular argument. I don't think anybody won the argument or lost the argument necessarily. It kind of was very mixed. What happened was technology. Eventually, the pornographic images of the world were simply brought to people in such a radically different way. And by the time the internet really started coming on, the control that any local government had over what was published and what wasn't published was lost, because it was all done federally, and it was done through, CDs and through various channels that simply couldn't be controlled anymore by a local prosecutor. But in the case of Charlie Hebdo, this is the question that we have to ask ourselves. In America, obscenity and the questions of censorship were always raised on a local basis. It was the question as to whether a local mayor of a little town somewhere in Iowa had the right to tell somebody that he thought a movie was obscene and he didn't want anybody to see it, just as much as a librarian in a public library has a question as how much power do they have to decide what books go in the library. Well, in America, the question is whether or not we actually think the federal government should ban anything, or question whether the federal government should have any control over what's published. And we have a tendency here to think that that is simply not the case, and that you can do anything you want. But within the artistic community, this raises a separate question. It isn't a question of whether you can do something. It's a question of whether you should do something. And in the art community, the argument is, does an individual artist have a social responsibility? And this question is still, in my opinion, very much discussed and very much argued within the artistic community of America. Now, there's a very important reason why this is done. And that is, we now have in this country a vast, I think it's kind of scary to really think about it, intelligentsia that lives and does nothing else but argue these kinds of issues amongst each other. I mean, that's what they do. But the public isn't in the argument necessarily. This is an argument amongst college professors and college graduate students and people. The university system in this country is just such an extraordinarily huge industrial system. It graduates so many people every year, and it propagates itself at every turn. But this is who has made this argument. And I was in I heard these arguments in the 1970s. And if you want an example of how this works, there was a couple of very famous writers back in the 70s. The most famous of which was a guy that wrote the book Lolita. And in it, he made the statement that really an art is nothing more than to have it is something that is created for pleasure. And the analogy that was made to it, his name was Vladimir Nabokov, and he argued that art was very much the same as a beautiful butterfly. That there wasn't any particular reason why a butterfly had to be as beautiful as it was, and art was beautiful for that just because it was, and that's what you wanted to do. And it was called art for art's sake. If you believe in art for art's sake, it means that the artist has absolutely no social responsibility and doesn't even have to care about whether or not anything he does has any effect, negative or positive, on the society he's in. If all you want to do is have pleasure, then in theory, and you have a high aesthetic, that would be an end in itself, and then you have the pleasure principle. The difficulty with this philosophy has always been that we don't see art that way, particularly in relation to our children. Concept in art that was argued again for 50 years called the bourgeois ethic. And the bourgeois ethic is the one in which you have a society that wants to try to use art as a way of molding character and having people learn something and to become a better human being by what they've read. And satire and humor often really violate this. And the artists see themselves as revolutionary, trying to change society. And this is the opposite point of view. I'm going to give you the complete opposite point of view of art for art's sake. The art for art's sake argument that is contrary is something a guy told me when I was in graduate school who was a PhD student. And I thought his opinion was not original, but it was the first time I'd heard it. He told me that the basis of art is to destroy your delusions or your illusions, that it's to wreck you as a human being and rebuild you. That what art is supposed to do is destroy every idea you have, because these ideas are likely not visionary enough, and they are probably very limited by some kind of what would consider to be a kind of middle class bourgeois limitation. Art's supposed to wreck those and then rebuild it. It's supposed to confront you. This is why he always told me that the only great art in the world is an art that would make you angry at some point because you didn't want to admit to the truth of what was being said. This is a very radical form of the idea of art, but it is still considered to be part of a vision by some people as to what the function of art is. It's contrary to what we now call the feel-good art. Feel-good art's about is it's reading a book or looking at a painting or reading a poem or watching a movie is very similar to having a really nice meal. You're a little hungry, you'd like something good, and you go in and you have this really nice, lovely dinner, and you feel better for it. This is what that kind of art's supposed to do. It's an entertainment, but it doesn't attack the central core values that you hold. And in fact, it's supposed to reinforce them. This reinforcement of values is what most of the time the left accuses the right of doing. The left wing for 50 years has said that what the right wing wants is an art that reinforces the value of the society that you already have. It doesn't question them. It doesn't attempt to go after anybody and really say that somebody's wrong. It tries to, again, to reinforce the values. And it's always described in the most cynical terms as, you know, God, mother, and apple pie. The thing is, the left is accused of something else entirely different by the right. And what the right accuses the left of is simply using art as a vehicle to destroy the existing order. But they don't necessarily have anything in place that's going to do anybody any good when the existing order's been destroyed. And in fact, the only object of the left is to destroy the existing order. It isn't to do anything else. Now, that's unfair because that would have been true maybe in 1960. But I would argue with you that now we're in a very much more difficult and complex situation in the year 2015. The left has had a great many victories within the government and societal areas, and they have far more going for them as far as what they can do now than they did in 1960 in many societies. If you lived in Georgia in 1955 in the United States, and you were a really big leftist, there wasn't much for you to look around at and think that you'd had a victory for anything. I mean, as far as civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, all the list of the left, there wasn't much going on in your favor. There were still states it was illegal for a black man and a white woman to marry. I mean, it was tough. It's not true now. And what I think is disingenuous from the left, very disingenuous, is that they will not admit to the fact that they now use art as a reinforcement tool in the same way that the right wing wanted to use it, and they accused the right wing of wanting to use it in the 1960s. And what the left does now, it promotes gay marriage, it promotes abortion, it promotes things within the society through the art world, and they believe it is a reinforcement of a value that the society should have. It's no longer a question of trying to convert people over necessarily. Because they, in many ways, for example, if you are sympathetic to this court system of the United States, which I have a lot of problems with, the judges in this country have made gay marriage legal in 36 states. That means there are more states now where it's legal for two men to get married than illegal. Weird. The judges say they never pass laws, but when they make a ruling, then they declare something legal. Anyway, that means now that if you are trying to advocate gay marriage, it means that you're not trying to convert over the minority because 36 of the states already have it. It's a reinforcement. Reinforcement across the board in many leftist things now of women's rights and all of these different issues. The right wing is disingenuous in claiming that it's doing nothing but trying to have a values that are old and they're trying to reinforce them. Because I would argue with you that the right wing in this country, which the conservative side of this country, which propagates itself in every election, is having the old values. I would argue with you that that's very question, that you could argue that's rather questionable as well. If you look at the way in which the conservatives run their governments now, it was created basically by Milton Friedman and other people, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't 100 years ago. I mean, the new neoconservative, neocon ideas in many ways, by world standards, are not all that old. But anyway, this is the whole issue of the reinforcement and the revolution. Charlie Hebdo, in a sense, I believe, was trying to promote itself out of the old revolutionary free speech idea of the left, in which it was trying to argue that when it drew these horrible pictures of Muhammad and made fun of the prophet and did these things, this was being done in a revolutionary spirit, which tried to say that we needed to be able to accept these things and the Muslims needed to be able to accept these things. And if you live in a free society, this is one of your social responsibilities, is to accept the fact that these things exist. The problem with this is, of course, the fact that what happens within satire and humor, and this is really key, is that eventually, if you carry it far enough, nothing is sacred. And it's been this issue is raised within artistic arguments all the time, is how do you live in a society where nothing is sacred? Well, there's nothing in the world you can't wreck. Because the truth is, if you went to these people who were really hardcore left, which I've talked to throughout my whole life, and you'd said the same thing about Barack Obama that they said about Muhammad, they would be just as mad as many of them would be just as angry at you as the Muslims were about what was said about Muhammad. It's a substitution principle. It's the idea that at some point in time, somebody has something in their life that they consider to be sacred, and you just don't stand there and make fun of them. This show now has been nothing more than an intro, so I'm going to have to do another show on the really specific situation of France, which I didn't get to. This is just kind of a big overview. So to end this in the last minute, I want to bring up my favorite character, and he's dead now, and that's Christopher Hitchens. Not my favorite, one of my favorite. Because I saw a speech he gave one time, and he gave hundreds and thousands of speeches. But in the midst of him rambling on about something to do with how much he hated Jesus or whatever he talked about on any given day, he made a comment that it was his right as a commentator to take the ideas of a Christian and ridicule them. That he had every right to stand up there and just tell them that they're stupid and that they're just really brain dead and that they basically have no right to exist. And he was very serious about it. That he considered this a right equal to, you know, the right of self-defense. And I think what Charlie Hebdo brings into question is to whether or not an individual human being's right to go around ridiculing somebody is actually a political right, or is it something that was made up for an entirely devious purpose and is now being used as an excuse to do things that we probably as a society shouldn't put up with. Thank you very much. I'm done for the day, and I am definitely going to have to do another show on this if I want to finish the subject. Thanks for listening, and have a great afternoon. Bye.